Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 6, the final episode on the topic of our discussion about the Sabbath. In our last episode, we looked at Matthew chapter 24 and what Yeshua said about praying that your flight from the abomination that causes desolation does not occur on the Sabbath. This then led us to a lengthy conversation about the principle of a Sabbath day's journey, which then, in turn, led us to discussing the perceived conundrum of honoring Shabbat during a biblical festival conference in a hotel convention center setting. For this episode, we'll go ahead and move to the next set of scripture verses that speak about Shabbat. The next verses in the Bible that mention Shabbat come to us from the Gospel of Luke in chapter 4. Verses 16 through 21 read this way, "And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath, and stood up to read. And the book of the prophet Yeshayahu, Isaiah, was handed to him. And he opened the book, and found the place where it was written, 'The Spirit of Adonai is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of Adonai.' And he closed the book, and gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him, and he began to say to them, 'Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing.'" Now the scene that unfolded in that synagogue on that Shabbat in Nazareth could be a topic of discussion all unto itself. But for now, let's highlight the pertinent areas to our discussion. We first see that in verse 16, it is said of Yeshua that it was his custom to enter the synagogue on Shabbat. Honestly, this entire series of episodes could be boiled down to that one verse. It was Yeshua's practice to attend services on Shabbat, and if I claim to be his follower, then I should do likewise. Simple. My work here is done. Okay, but seriously, this point cannot be overemphasized, for numerous reasons. Reason number one, as already stated, if that's what the master did, then we should do likewise. A disciple does as his master does. If I'm a disciple of Yeshua, my life should reflect his, to the best of my understanding and ability. If his consistent practice, as verse 16 communicates it was, is to attend a service on Shabbat, then I should follow his example. Point number two, this implies fulfilling the commandment to make Shabbat a mikra kodesh, as we've discussed several times throughout the series. We're instructed to have a holy convocation on Shabbat. This can't be done unless we're gathered with other believers. In attending synagogue services each Shabbat, Yeshua fulfilled this command, and so should we. Point number three, when we are in the presence of others with whom we share our faith, we should be in the practice of reading the scriptures aloud to one another, just as we see Yeshua doing in this passage. Why is this so important? Because as we know from Romans chapter 10, verse 17, faith comes from hearing, and hearing by the word of Messiah. It is through the process of hearing the words of Messiah spoken aloud that we're able to build up our faith. It's one thing to read them silently to ourselves. It's a whole other thing to hear them being read aloud by others, and yet another level is reached when we read them aloud to others ourselves. In each circumstance, another sense is engaged in the learning process. Reading to yourself engages your sight. Hearing someone else read engages your hearing. Reading aloud to others engages your speech. The more senses you engage, the more likely it will become that you will imprint that information into your mind. So, by definition, gathering with other believers where the word is read aloud will lead to an increase in your amount of faith. This is why the Mikra Kodesh element of Shabbat is so important. We were created to interact with others. It's only when we're interacting with one another, hearing the words of Messiah, that we can fulfill the admonition of Paul to the church at Colossae when he said, "Let the word of Messiah richly dwell within you, with all wisdom, teaching, and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with thankfulness in your hearts to Elohim." In this passage, Paul references the word of Messiah dwelling within you. This echoes the statement from Romans that faith comes by hearing the word of Messiah. And here in this passage, it's tied to teaching and admonishing one another with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. This can only be accomplished if we're in each other's presence, speaking with one another. The natural context for that, of course, would be on Shabbat. The next occurrence in Scripture where we see Shabbat mentioned is in Luke chapter 13. Starting in verse 10, we see this description. And he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And there was a woman who for 18 years had had a sickness caused by a spirit. And she was bent double and could not straighten up at all. When Yeshua saw her, he called her over and said to her, Woman, you are freed from your sickness. And he laid hands on her, and immediately she was made erect again and began glorifying Elohim. But the synagogue official, indignant because Yeshua had healed on the Sabbath, began saying to the crowd in response, There are 6 days in which work should be done, so come during them and get healed, and not on the Sabbath day. But the Lord answered him and said, You hypocrites! Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him? And this woman, a daughter of Abraham as she is, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day? As he said this, all his opponents were being humiliated, and the entire crowd was rejoicing over all the glorious things being done by him. Can you imagine? There are several incredulous things to point out here before we get to the main points. First, can you imagine being in the place of this woman? She had been essentially crippled for 18 years. She couldn't even stand up straight. How difficult and painful this must have been for her. Second, can you imagine the unmitigated gall of the synagogue leader to rebuke Yeshua for relieving this woman of her great pain and torment? It should be irrelevant what day of the week it was. They should have all been rejoicing to see such a thing. Third, how is this considered work? All he did was speak to her and lay his hands on her and she was healed. So even the objections cited by the leader of the synagogue made zero sense, as did his reaction to such a wonderful event. But back to the point here, we have another evidence, as we discussed in episode 4, when we looked at Matthew chapter 12, of Yeshua healing someone on the Sabbath in the synagogue. Both the man with the withered hand in Matthew chapter 12 and the woman bent over in Luke 13 were crippled in ways that prevented them from being full contributors to society. Yet neither of them was shown kindness, respect, or compassion by anyone in the synagogues, at least according to the limited information we have at our disposal in regards to these two people. It required Yeshua showing up and seeing their condition in order for their healing to become manifested, resulting in their restoration. Further, we see Yeshua once again in the synagogue on Shabbat among the people. It's when we are among our brothers and sisters that we, like our example Yeshua, can see the wounds, the hurts, and the pains of our fellow, and we can act to bring them at least some measure of healing in their lives. Once again, if we call ourselves followers of Yeshua, we should do as he did and seek to bring healing and restoration to those with whom we are in fellowship. But that can only happen if we're actually in fellowship with others. We have to make this a priority in our walk of faith. Yes, I know, you aren't going to get along the greatest with everyone who attends the local congregations near you. In fact, some of the people there might even irritate you. Good. Maybe they need to irritate you, because perhaps Adonai is using them to expose the ugly parts within you that you need to be healed of. In fact, maybe you are the one that needs to be healed. In that case, keeping yourself from fellowshipping with others on Shabbat will only leave you like the woman in Luke 13, living with your pain and discomfort for far too long. I would encourage you to seek to be in fellowship with others. Ask for prayer. Allow others to speak into your life. Expose yourself to the reading of the Word. Increase your faith and speak to others in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. I've already said it, but it bears repeating. We were created to be in relationship with others. When Adonai created man, he recognized that man was not meant to live alone. This is why he commanded man to be fruitful and multiply. If we desire to bear fruit and to multiply for his kingdom, it requires us to be in fellowship with others, particularly on his Shabbat, when he's instructed us to congregate together. There's a theme in the book of John concerning this topic. Almost every single reference to the Sabbath in the Gospel of John records an incident where Yeshua healed someone on Shabbat. We see this in John chapter 5, verses 5 through 18, where Yeshua comes across a man who'd been ill for 38 years. 38 years. Now, we're not told how old this man was, but it's probably pretty safe to say he had been sick pretty much his entire life. Yeshua tells this man to pick up his pallet and walk. He was instantly healed and followed Yeshua's instruction. He picked up his pallet and walked away. Only one problem. This took place on Shabbat. Telling this man to pick up his pallet and carry it was a violation against the things we discussed in episode 2 that were implemented by Nehemiah during the construction of the Second Temple. These prohibitions, of course, were based upon the warnings issued by the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah. So it would seem that Yeshua was instructing this man to do something that was in direct violation of a biblical prohibition, to carry a load. But the point of having the man pick up his pallet and carry it was in order to be a visible testimony of the awesome healing power of Adonai. This man had been going to the same spot for decades in hopes of being healed. Everyone there knew him. They knew where he parked himself. Yet here he was, walking through town, healed, not a care in the world, carrying the sign of his infirmity as a witness to his deliverance. For our next verse, we'll stay in the book of John. Now, we're going to skip over the next passage in John that comes to us out of chapter 7, and we'll go to the third passage first in chapter 9 because it fits in with the theme of what we've been talking about here. So in chapter 9, if you begin in verse 1, you'll see that Yeshua encounters a man who was born blind. In verse 6, Yeshua does something a bit weird. It says, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes. So Yeshua spits in some dirt and rubs the mud into this blind dude's eyes. Can you imagine? Kind of strange. But we're going to see there was a purpose in it. So Yeshua then tells the blind man with the newly applied dirt mascara to go wash in the pool of Shiloh. The blind guy follows Yeshua's instructions, and after washing, his sight is restored and he can see. The people who witnessed this formerly blind guy, now seeing, bring him to the synagogue for examination by the spiritual leaders. That's where verse 13 picks up. It says there, they brought to the Pharisees the man who was formerly blind. Now it was the Sabbath on the day when Yeshua made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also were asking him again how he received his sight, and he said to them, he applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Therefore some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from Elohim, because he does not keep the Sabbath. Yet again, we see the spiritual elite failing to see the forest for the trees. It was truly the Pharisees who were blind, and not the man who was born that way. They couldn't see past their insistence upon man-made additions to the commands of Sabbath in order to see that a miracle had happened. A man born blind had been healed and could see. This should have prompted them to rejoice and sing praises to Adonai Rapha, the Lord our healer. But these men instead were so concerned with the fact that Yeshua had made some mud and put it on the guy's eyes that they completely overlooked that he had been set free from a lifetime of oppression. In yet another example of the principle of Kal Vachomer, we should recognize that the welfare and blessing of others should always take priority over adherence to the instructions found within the scriptures. In fact, the intention behind the instructions from the Bible are intended to be for the welfare and blessing of creation. The entire motivation for the commands concerning the Sabbath are there for the welfare and the blessing of the children of Israel. Once we lose sight of that fact, we miss the entire intent of what Shabbat is about. If we find ourselves more concerned about how people are keeping Shabbat, rather than being excited about the fact that they are attempting to honor Adonai by keeping Shabbat, then we've missed the entire point, and we're just every bit as blind as the Pharisees. This same point is illustrated a few chapters prior to what we just read. If we back up to John chapter 7, if we read verses 22 and 23, Yeshua there says, for this reason, Moshe has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moshe, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the Torah of Moshe will not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? One more example of the principle of Kal Vachomer. In this case, the positive command of circumcision holds more importance than the negative command to do no work on Shabbat. If it was acceptable to perform circumcision on the Shabbat, how much more then was it acceptable to heal a person of their maladies on Shabbat? In all three of these examples from the book of John, the gospel account makes it clear that the principle of performing good, of blessing others, of bringing healing to the sick, the infirm, the downtrodden, all these things were preferable over any other command found within the scriptures. Yeshua came, as he announced in the Nazarene synagogue, to proclaim freedom to the captives, to bring good news to the afflicted, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and freedom to the prisoners. As his disciples, we should be emulating the example of Messiah. Our focus should be on bringing restoration and healing to all his children. As stated through the prophet Samuel, has Adonai as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Adonai? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. And then there's this from the prophet Micah. He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does Adonai require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your Elohim. Even if we are meticulous in our obedience to the minutiae of his instructions, if we're not doing it in an others-centered fashion, motivated by our love for him and love for our neighbors, then we're doing it all wrong. Finally, our last few passages for examination from the scriptures in regards to the topic of Shabbat come to us from the book of Acts. First, we'll take a look at Acts chapter 13. In Acts 13, Paul is called to pair up with Barnabas, and they're both called to go then preach the gospel. Where does chapter 13 say that they go? As we can see from verse 5, verse 14, verse 15, and verse 27, they went to the synagogue on Sabbath, where the word was being preached. Then we see in verses 42 through 44, it says this, "As Paul and Barnabas were going out, the people kept begging them that these things might be spoken to them the next Sabbath. Now when the meeting of the synagogue had broken up, many of the Jews and of the Elohim-fearing proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, were urging them to continue in the grace of Elohim. The next Sabbath, nearly the whole city assembled to hear the word of Adonai." Now keep in mind, Paul's ministry began years after Yeshua's resurrection. Yeshua's resurrection happened somewhere between the years AD 30 and 33, depending upon which source you look into. Paul's conversion experience took place somewhere between 2 to 7 years after that. Then Paul spent considerable time in both Damascus and Arabia, unlearning some of his prior training under Gamaliel and relearning things in light of Yeshua. So it was somewhere between 5 to 10 years after Yeshua's resurrection that he and Barnabas were teamed up, probably closer to the 10-year mark than the 5-year mark. So if Yeshua had in any way done away with the practice of meeting in the synagogue on Shabbat, his disciples clearly didn't get that message, because years later, here they were, still doing the very same thing, going to the synagogue on Shabbat. In fact, due in part to the work of Peter, then combined with Barnabas and Paul's efforts, many people who were not Jewish by birth had been brought into the synagogue. This is the reference to the Elohim-fearing proselytes mentioned in verse 43. Despite the fact that these non-Jews were being reached, however, they were still to be found in the synagogue on the Sabbath. There weren't separate meeting places for Gentiles only. They were there, present in the synagogues. This dovetails perfectly with the final passage that we'll look at. This passage appears 2 chapters later in Acts chapter 15. Now, this chapter is a whole episode or two of conversation all within itself, but allow me to sum it up this way. Chapter 15 addresses the issue of how to handle all this influx of non-Jews coming into the congregations of believers. We won't be getting too much into those details at this time, because once we open that can of worms, we'll end up talking about really important things, but things that are not related to our topic in this program about the Shabbat. But keeping to the subject of the Shabbat, we see in Acts chapter 15 that there's a debate that arises about how Gentiles should be dealt with when they came to faith. After much deliberation, Yaakov, James, the brother of Yeshua, who is by this time the leader of the synagogue of Messianic believers in Jerusalem, he issues this statement, "Therefore, it is my judgment that we do not trouble those who are turning to Elohim from among the Gentiles, but that we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled and from blood. For Moshe, from ancient generations, has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogue every Sabbath." Now, again, there's a lot that we could comment on here. And I'll get to that in a later program when we address the entirety of Acts chapter 15. But for now, to focus on the aspect of Shabbat, we can conclude several things from this verdict from James. The question at hand was, what do we do with these Gentiles who are coming to faith? The answer is, let's tell them to do these four things. Why? Because these four things that are mentioned are associated with pagan practices and idolatry. We'll discuss that in another program. But then, after James states that, he says that they are to submit doing these four things, then he starts talking about Moshe. Why?
Why? Why?
Why?
His mention of Moshe in verse 21 is a reference to the Torah. He says, for Moshe is read in the synagogue every Sabbath. In other words, in every city, there's a synagogue. In every one of those synagogues, Moshe, the Torah, is read every Shabbat. The suggestion James is making here is that once Gentiles profess faith in Messiah, they will hear Moshe being preached in the synagogues on Shabbat. Why would it matter if Moshe is read in the synagogue on Shabbat within the context of the question, what shall we do about these Gentiles? Because it was expected that these non-Jews would attend the synagogue services on Shabbat. As Barnabas and Paul shared the gospel message to the masses in the open squares of the cities they visited, these Gentiles responded to that message. From there, they were pointed to the synagogues and meeting places of the believers, which all met on Shabbat throughout all the cities of the Roman Empire. Thus, the Gentiles who responded to the gospel message would end up hearing Moshe, the Torah, being read every Shabbat. It was in those assemblies that they would learn why Shabbat was so important. They would hear about the Feast of Adonai. They would hear about keeping a biblically clean diet. Thus, they would learn, by attending Shabbat services, what Adonai expected of them as his adopted children. By going to the synagogue and meeting places of the believers on Shabbat, they would learn about the sign that Shabbat is and how important it is to Adonai. They would hear passages like Exodus chapter 31, verse 13, which says, "You shall surely observe my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am Adonai who sanctifies you." We have inherited the benefit of those early Gentile believers who came to faith. If not for them and for their example, I would still be outside of the covenant. All praise be to the Father who provided a way through his Son for me, who was once a stranger to the covenants, to be able to approach him, to be drawn near to him. All thanks be unto our King, who has brought us unto himself and instructed us to honor his Sabbaths, that we might know that he is Adonai who sanctifies us. All right, so now that we have covered over the course of the last six episodes all the verses throughout the Bible that discuss the topic of Shabbat, now what? How do we take these commands and apply them to our lives? How do we live this out? How can we interpret some of the commands that were given to farmers and herdsmen in the wilderness and apply it to our 21st century lifestyle? Well, now that we've gone through the Bible and looked at what it has to say on the topic of Shabbat, we can draw several conclusions out, most of which have been covered along the way through these last six episodes. But for the next few minutes, let's do a recap. Let's do an overview of all of these verses. In this overview, we will attempt to translate them into modern cultural applications for us so that we can apply them to our lives. So let's go back and look at the verses we've discussed in this program and discuss them again briefly in the order in which they appeared and see how we can glean from them in order to establish some acceptable patterns for our lives. So the first passage we discussed was Exodus chapter 16, verses 22 through 30. There are several things that stand out in this passage that could be incorporated into our weekly observance practices. For instance, we discussed at length that the Sabbath is a day on which we are to do no work. But what is work exactly? We live in an increasingly virtual world. Can I answer work emails on Shabbat? I mean, that doesn't take any real effort, right? It's not strenuous, so I can be resting while I'm doing it, right? Well, technically, while this may have some veracity, one has to ask the question, is that what Adonai would consider resting from your labors? This is a struggle I deal with on a regular basis. Here at the ministry, I handle our marketplace, so I'm constantly answering messages and emails from customers who have ordered products from us. Some of them contact us on Shabbat. Some of them contact us on what is our Shabbat, but they're across the globe somewhere and their Shabbat's already done. As a general rule, I tend not to reply to those messages until after Shabbat is over, with rare exceptions to that rule. Not because I can point to any specific verse and say, see, here it says, I shouldn't answer these emails. Instead, I'm trying to live by a principle. That principle is that if it's work-related, it can wait until after the time that my king has requested from me is finished. Allow me to give you this example. My wife hates it when she's talking to me, but I am busy texting with someone, answering emails, or in general looking at my phone for some reason. Now, she's generally very kind and patient with me in those moments, but she definitely dislikes it. It's not so much that she's demanding my full attention or something like that. It's more that she knows from prior experience that the things that she's telling me at that moment while I'm looking at my phone, chances are pretty high that later I'm going to be much less likely to remember at that time what she said than if I'm looking directly at her while she's speaking. There's something about giving her my full attention that gives me a much better recall of our conversations. In the same way, Adonai is asking us to look directly at him on Shabbat. If we're busy looking at our work emails or Facebook posts or news articles or sports games or any other number of things that take our eyes off the Father, then we're much less likely to remember the things he's speaking to us on Shabbat. If we truly desire intimacy with our King, we should try our best to shut out all distractions on Shabbat that take our focus off of him. So whatever it is that we do in our lives that can be equated to going out and collecting manna, we should consider the principle from Exodus 16 to cease from doing that on Shabbat. Additionally, there's a phrase that's used in verse 23 that establishes another principle, at least in my household. There are some here at the ministry that don't see eye to eye with me on this topic, but I don't see them around here on this program, so you're only going to get my views on this today. Verse 23 says, bake what you'll bake and boil what you'll boil, in regards to Friday's preparation of their manna. We could make the argument that this instruction applied only and specifically to the manna while the children of Israel were wandering in the wilderness. Thus, once the children of Israel crossed the Jordan and entered the Promised Land, and the manna ceased, so did this instruction. You could also make the argument that the reason why they did that was so that it wouldn't rot the next day, as we saw in other examples in that passage. I can appreciate that perspective. But I'm going to point to normative Judaism and ask the question, if this principle went away when the manna ceased, why has Judaism continued to avoid cooking food on Shabbat? In fact, if you look at your oven, most modern ovens have a Sabbath mode on them, where it will keep your oven at a consistent low temperature for long periods of time.
If your control panel displays a backward C on the left side of the display, the control has been set to Sabbath mode. When any function is programmed in Sabbath mode, the control panel will not beep or change its display.
This is because it's been determined through the rabbinic works that keeping food warm on Shabbat is acceptable, but actually cooking it is not. Now, while I'm not wanting to get into the details of why Judaism does this, nor am I wanting to discuss all the plethora of regulations they attach to this topic, I am interested in the fact that this practice still exists, long after the manna has disappeared. To me, that communicates that the principle was not specific to the manna, but it's a basic principle of Shabbat. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil on Friday, so that you don't have to cook on Shabbat. But Daniel, you might argue, I enjoy cooking. Okay, there are six other days of the week available to you for cooking. Cook all you like on those other 6 days. Do you not enjoy cooking on those other days? Do you only enjoy cooking on Shabbat? Now, I can't speak for other homes, nor is it my place to do so. But for me and my house, we see this as a principle that we should follow. So in our home, we avoid cooking anything on Shabbat. We use crock pots started the night before to keep things warm or otherwise enjoy foods that don't require cooking on Shabbat. If one simply plans in advance, it's easy to avoid cooking on Shabbat. Am I suggesting that it's sinful to cook something on Shabbat? No, not at all. But for me and my house, We desire to err on the side of caution, and we see the principle expressed in Exodus chapter 16. Something to keep in mind, what it says there in Exodus 16, it's not some extra command added to Scripture by man. It was spoken by Adonai through Moshe. So for me personally, I heed these words. I'm not saying you have to follow my lead. I'm just presenting the information to you. You can make up your own mind on what's right for your own household. Now, we also see in Exodus chapter 16 the instruction for every man to stay in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. We discussed this in a previous episode. Traditionally, the rabbinic works have interpreted the meaning of place to mean city. So travel within your city on Shabbat was deemed acceptable. But as we discussed, the Sabbath day's journey was then instituted. Please refer to episode 5 for more on this topic. We can see from the description given in Exodus chapter 20 that no one is to work on Shabbat. Not you, none of your family members, none of your servants, not even your animals or the foreigners who are among you. These words were spoken from Mount Sinai by Adonai himself in the hearing of all the people. This is what we refer to as the Ten Commandments. Words that most of the Judeo-Christian faith takes pretty seriously. Unfortunately, we live in a world where we are surrounded by those who do not take those words seriously. This results in plenty of examples all around us of people who do work on Shabbat. Ultimately, it's not our place to judge them. It's not our place to criticize them or to look down upon them or in any way disparage them. The Lord of the Sabbath will deal with them in His timing. But it is within our purview to ensure that we do all that we can within our span of control to avoid working on Shabbat. If at all possible, we, our children, our households, and anyone over whom we have authority should abstain from working on Shabbat. I have 6 children. My wife homeschools them, which is, by the way, a job that is far harder than what I do. But this means that our family only has 1 income for all 8 of us. Believe me, I know the temptation to work on Shabbat. I have bills to pay too. But ultimately, the one who owns the cattle on 1,000 hills will provide. I may not ever own all the things I'd like to own, do all the things I'd like to do, or enjoy all the experiences that I would like to experience. But if I honor the Shabbat, if I abstain from working on that day, He will provide all of my needs. That's all I can ask for. My master has been good to me. He's given me a wonderful wife and terrific children. I have pledged my loyalty to Him, and I am going to serve Him all my days, and I will live according to the rules of His household as a result. This includes abstaining from pursuing any work on Shabbat, and instead, relying upon His faithfulness to provide for my family through my efforts the other 6 days of the week. He's always done so, and so I have no reason to believe that He will fail to fulfill His word to us in the future. Moving on to the next pertinent passage, we see in Exodus chapter 35 the instruction, "You shall not kindle a fire." We talked about kindling a fire a bit in some of the previous episodes, so I won't belabor that here, but I will address another type of fire that we might find ourselves in violation of kindling on Shabbat. That is the kindling of a fire of contention. As people of the book, we tend to be very passionate and zealous about our study of Scripture. Unfortunately, sometimes that leads us into very heated discussions and disputes. I love to debate. Anyone who knows me knows that I do not back down easily from a challenge, and I will debate virtually anyone at virtually any time. But I have learned the hard way that I have to restrain myself, particularly on Shabbat. While I can remain objective and topic-oriented in my debates most of the time, not everyone can do that. Additionally, I can become very boisterous and animated in my defense of my position, and this can very easily be mistaken for anger. Causing strife between brothers is one of the 7 things Adonai says He abhors in Proverbs chapter 6. We need to be extra cautious on Shabbat in particular to avoid strife. I'm not saying that you have to back down and agree with positions that you disagree with. I am, however, saying that we need to be particularly cautious in our posture, our language, and our tone when we are having discussions with others on Shabbat. It's possible that we can be 100% correct in our position and yet be 100% wrong in the way we present or deliver our message. This can drive people away. And then we're fighting against Adonai's command for us to convocate with others on His day. So when we read, "You shall not kindle a fire on Shabbat," We should also understand this to mean to stir up strife among the brethren with vain disputes and arguments. Instead, we should focus on the areas we do agree with one another and actively encourage one another. None of us is 100% correct 100% of the time. We're all likely wrong about something. That being the case, let's extend grace to those with whom we disagree and not allow our disagreements with them to cause either of us to become disagreeable. Instead, as Paul expressed in Romans 12:18, let's, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. We should be making Sabbath a delight, as the prophet Isaiah said, "How blessed is the man who does this, and the son of man who takes hold of it, who keeps his foot from profaning the Sabbath and keeps his hand from doing any evil." If on Shabbat we cease from doing our own pleasure, if we delight ourselves in Shabbat, then Adonai has promised to make us ride on the heights of the earth. He will cause the Sabbath to become a day of joy and peace for us. This becomes a cyclical pattern. If we sow joy and peace toward others on Shabbat, he will cause those things to return to us multiplied. Test him at this. Try to prove this statement correct. I promise you that if you make Shabbat a delight, if you sow peace and joy on that day in particular, that he will fulfill this word to you, and you will enjoy peace and joy that overwhelm you on the Sabbath. Our approach to Shabbat should always be to recognize that it's a sign between him and us. As we discussed in a previous episode, the Shabbat is a sign to the world in the same way that a wedding band is a sign to others. It communicates that we are his and that he is ours. With that in mind, I encourage you to invite him to meet with you on Shabbat and see if he doesn't fill you with delight and peace. Rest in him, and he will give you the desires of your heart. And on that apropos note, we bring this episode and this series on the topic of Shabbat to an end. I pray that you have enjoyed this series and that it has been a blessing to you. We have some big plans for our next series. Please make sure to tune into our next episode, in which we'll begin to speak about the links between Torah and Yeshua. We refer to Yeshua as the Word made flesh. But how accurate is this statement? What does it really mean within the context that it was given in? What did the Apostle John mean in the opening words of his gospel account? To answer that, we'll spend several episodes digging into numerous texts in addition to the Bible. We'll also be blessed with some very special guests who will be joining me for a discussion on this topic, which I am very excited about. So join us for our next episode, Are Torah and Yeshua Synonymous Terms? Until then, Shalom.